Welcome back to What Page Are You On? It's been a while, but I'm still me, Bethany Rutter, one of your co-hosts, and you are...
It's me, Alice Slater, your other co-host.
It's been a while, hasn't it, my friend?
How long has it been?
Well, I went to Japan in early March, and we probably didn't record one. Did one come out while I was in Japan? Basically, it's been like 9 months, about.
We could have had a baby in this time.
We literally created a human child. I stand by our decision to kind of... to pause for a bit.
It just didn't feel right. I felt like at the beginning of the pandemic, I wasn't reading. And
I had too much stuff going on.
And the thing with a books podcast is you really need to have read some fucking books.
Yeah. Yeah. And my life has changed so much since the beginning of the pandemic, and how I read books has changed a lot as well for related reasons.
So let's start off with asking, how has your reading habits changed? What did it look like at the beginning of the pandemic, and what does your reading look like now?
So pre-pandemic, I would read mostly on my commute. I would mostly read Kindle books or proofs that I was sent by our good friends at publishers. I would, you know, get through maybe one audiobook a month on my Audible subscription. But now, I don't commute at all because I lost my job.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I now permanently work from home. But as a result of being made redundant, I started my business, my woman-owned business, as we like to call it, which is making polymer clay earrings. And that has meant that I just listen to so many audiobooks while I work. So that's really changed. Like, I get through so many more audiobooks than I used to. I basically have like no books that are unlistened to.
Wow.
Quite a big stack in my Audible account waiting for me to listen to them. But yeah, I really don't read a lot of Kindle or physical books. Like, yeah.
You're an audio gal now.
I'm now audio, which is, you know, nice because it means I still get to consume books. But yeah, it just... my life has just changed in a way that means that I don't really make time for reading in the way that I had it kind of baked into my schedule. How about you, my friend?
Well, kind of a similar story. I still have my day job. So I work from home 4 days a week. I've had to lose 1 day was my sacrifice to COVID. So I'm working like 4 days a week instead of a full 5 days a week. I'm no longer commuting, and I didn't realize how much of my reading was just based around convenience. So I did most of my reading on the tube. I was traveling from East London to West London. So 40 minutes on the tube every day, twice a day. So I would tear through books like that. And then also in my office job, I would read in my lunch breaks more often than not. So I would easily clock in like 2.5 hours of reading every day. And that would just be part of my daily routine. I didn't even have to think about it.
And also we were actively reading stuff for the pod. So by virtue of the pod, there wasn't that kind of...
no sense of urgency. I definitely ended up, I've always found it quite difficult to read at home anyway. I'm very distracted by my phone, my husband. I have quite a busy, well, I had quite a busy social life. So I would go out quite often during the week to meet friends, to go to book events, that kind of thing. I've definitely had to like retrain my brain to read in a different way. I've always split my reading between physical books, probably 70% physical and then 30% Kindle and audio. I think that split has kind of changed as well. I'm listening to more audio just because I'm in my house more, so I'm more likely to put an audiobook on than music if I'm alone, whereas I'll listen to music if I'm, you know, hanging out with my husband. And then I'm also finding that I'm reading more late into the night. And then I'm more likely to read a Kindle just because I could do that without the light being switched on.
Yeah, that's a true plus of reading on your phone. And obviously we haven't addressed a new reality of the pod, which is, for the first time ever, we are not in the same place.
And I'm finding this weird. I feel like I'm on a little business Skype call, except I'm in what I'm going to call the dream chamber. I'm in my bed with a blanket over my head to try and give a good audio sound. Same. So LMK, if the audio is good for you guys.
Yeah, this is about as good as we're probably going to get it without having to spend quite a bit of money. So hopefully this sounds, you know, listenable, no worse than usual.
I would definitely be prepared to spend money on a microphone if it meant I didn't have to sit under a blanket. Maybe I'll make a little nest somewhere. I'll make a nest in a cupboard and just staple blankets to the walls.
So we thought when we brought back this pod, we would kind of go down a slightly different route to what we had done in the past. Alice, would you like to tell our good friends listening at home what the new vibe is, what the Renaissance vibe?
Okay, so what we're going to try and do is produce more episodes more frequently, but make them shorter. That does mean we're not going to be working so hard to create book pairings. We're going to be reading more naturally and then discussing what we read. Whatever that may be. So sometimes our books may be totally different. Sometimes we may not have read each other's book. Sometimes we may have both read the same thing. And then we're also going to do more like book world conversation as well. So like if there's something buzzy happening, then we might give our little take on it, whether that's a prize long list or a new website that's launched or, you know, just a bit of drama. Yeah, because I live for book goss. I fucking love it. And I love having a platform to talk about it.
That isn't the DMs with Jordan Taylor Jones.
Exactly. Although I'll still be doing that as well.
That is as good an outlet as any. So what are you reading right now, Alice? Or what have you read recently? What's your reading status right now?
Okay, so I literally just this morning finished reading a thriller by Ruth Ware called The Turn of the Key.
Like The Turn of the Screw?
Exactly. So it's a retelling of The Turn of the Screw, which I also read this year and I hated, by the way. I found The Turn of the Screw just very verbose. Henry James loves super long sentences and he packs loads of clauses in them. And even though The Turn of the Screw is super short, it took me 6 days to plow through.
You might as well just watch the film. Watch The Innocence. That's the film. Honestly, just watch the film.
Well, I read the book because I was like, oh, I'm going to read the book ahead of watching The Haunting of Bly Manor because I'm a big horror movie fan and I loved The Haunting of Hill House. Unfortunately, then everyone hated The Haunting of Bly Manor, so I was kind of turned off watching it anyway. And I'd plowed through this book for nothing. But it did mean that I had a better idea of what Ruth Ware was doing with The Turn of the Key, which was just a coincidental read that I picked up next. So The Turn of the Key is about a woman who is hired to be a nanny in like a smart house in a remote area of Scotland. So this house is in the middle of nowhere. It's a really old building that's been zhuzhed up with this app called the Happy App. And like, it sounds like my worst nightmare. Every single function in the house revolves around this app, from like turning lights on to checking where the children are to doing this shopping and stuff. And basically, while she's in this house, the children are really difficult. The parents have gone on a business trip almost immediately, so she's alone with them and with this nightmare app that she can't work. And then she starts hearing footsteps at night. And it is so fucking creepy. I read it all exclusively late at night with my husband sleeping beside me, and it was chilling me out so much. Not chilling me out, the opposite, giving me chills. So yeah, I really recommend it. Although it's a little, it's very commercial. So like, don't go in there expecting a good literary ghost story. It's like a super commercial quick read, but it's great.
As long as those are good, I do not begrudge their existence. In fact, all I really want is to read something that's readable and also good.
Exactly. And I do find that Ruth Ware can be a little bit hit or miss.
Yeah, like, I feel like I read maybe her first one and then her subsequent one didn't seem like such a hit. So I fell off the wagon and didn't read anymore.
I think In the Dark, Dark Wood was her first one. And it was a really great whodunit about a hen party in a cabin in the woods.
Yes.
Just good, fun, quick read. And then The Woman in Cabin 10, I just thought sucked so hard. And I don't normally go like negative on the pod. Like normally we skirt around books we don't like, but I thought it was a real miss, and I don't want anyone to pick it up off the basis of me discussing it right now. So
what is an unforgivable sin in thriller narrative?
A coincidence.
We hate when the resolution hinges on coincidences.
You're allowed to have a coincidence in which it brings two unlikely characters together. Yeah. Like, you know, that moment of someone spots someone from their past that they recognize, that kind of coincidence is chill because that can happen and that's what gets the action going. But I think if a plot point hinges on a coincidence, I'm going to be disappointed in that. If more than one hinges on a coincidence, I just think you can't plot novels.
You shouldn't have written this novel, and it shouldn't have been published.
Yeah, because it's like, who are you, Charles Dickens? Like, just because Great Expectations hinges on a coincidence doesn't mean that it's the better for it. I hated that about Great Expectations. So, yeah, fuck coincidences.
Okay, well, I'm glad that I now know what you've been reading, because I had literally no idea that that book existed. I had never heard of The Turn of the Key, or whatever. Is that what it's called, Turn of the Key?
Yeah, The Turn of the Key.
I had not heard of that at all. I feel like maybe I'm slightly disconnected from the thriller scene now.
Well, we'll dive back into that, but first of all, I want to know what you're reading.
So, I'm not really reading anything with my eyeballs at the moment. The last book I read was by the dude who runs the bloody creative writing program at UEA, your alma mater.
Andrew Cowan.
Yeah, so I have a buddy who I hope is listening. My friend John Cudby. We live quite close to each other, and he's been one of my pandemic friends who I go for a walk with and, you know, eat a pizza in Dulwich Park with. And he lent me this book and was like, I really enjoyed this. And so I started reading it, and I really enjoyed it too. And it's really, I haven't really read, I can't think of a book that I would compare it to. It's basically like the story of a childhood told from the perspective of the child, in that kind of weird memory way. I don't know. Yeah, someone who kind of doesn't fully understand what's going on, but also written as an adult with some understanding of what was going on.
Like a retrospective narrative.
Yeah, but it's just got this kind of weird veil over it of kind of darkness. And I really liked it. And it was published by Salt Publishing, who are some good indie people.
I like Salt. I think Salt do some good stuff.
I agree.
What was that one called, sorry?
It's called Your Fault by Andrew Cowan.
Your Fault.
Yeah, so that was the last book I read with my eyeballs. But as I said, I've been really on the old audiobook lifestyle. So the last book I listened to, which, you know, they basically become the same thing, me reading books is just something I now do with my ears, was Marisha Pessel's Calamity Physics. What's it called?
Special Topics. I don't know it.
It's called Special Topics in Calamity Physics. And it was, I think it was her debut, because I went wild on the internet earlier this summer when I listened to Marisha Pessel's novel Night Film, which I loved so much. Like, I think it is flawed, and I don't think everyone will love it as much as I did. But me listening to Night Film was like the highlight of my life. It's so dark. It's so, yeah, I loved it. I loved how dark it was. I loved the plot. I loved how your perception of things really changes.
One thing for Night Film.
It's very, very, very long.
I made it through halfway on audio, because I tend to listen to audio in quite short bursts, because I mainly do it while I do housework, and I hate housework. I found after maybe 6 weeks, I was still only halfway, and I was like, I have to knock this on the head. I can't continue listening to this epic in like bite-sized pieces. It's killing me.
Yeah, whereas I think because I tend to listen to things in quite long stretches, like I'll spend kind of maybe 4 or 5 hours in one go listening to something while I'm making clay or if I'm home alone or whatever. So that it was like ideal for listening a Night Film, because I was just so into it that I was listening to it all the time. I started listening to Special Topics in Calamity Physics and wasn't as into, like, the world of Night Film is much juicier to me than, because it's based around a kind of reclusive cult horror film / snuff film director. And then Special Topics in Calamity Physics is told from the point of view of like a very precocious teenage girl with a very annoying dad who's an academic. And so I wasn't really on board with, especially with the narrator of Special Topics in Calamity Physics. But then once it got going, I was like, yes, 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 this is good shit. So I'm not as enthusiastic about it as Night Film, but I did really enjoy it. So that's the last thing I listened to.
What am I listening to right now? I've got an audiobook on the go. It's, do you know Grady Hendrix? He's a horror writer, and he did My Best Friend's Exorcism, which is a very fun, super 80s, Jennifer's Body-esque novel. So he's written a companion piece to that, because in My Best Friend's Exorcism, parents are mostly absent. Like, it's very much focused on the teenagers. So he's written this book about Southern moms, and it's called The Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires.
This sounds right up your street.
Yeah, and like, I don't know if I would necessarily say it's blowing my mind. Like, it's a very cozy horror novel, but then it has like the coziness of a Southern mom who's baking pies and going to book clubs and raising their children. And then when it's violent, it is so incredibly gross. Like, it's really strange. It's got a really strange tone, but I'm quite enjoying it. We'll see how I feel by the time I finish it. But right now I'm having a good time.
I am delighted for you.
So yeah, earlier you said that you don't feel like you're keeping up, particularly in the world of thrillers. That is something else that I have found in terms of my reading in the pandemic, is that I definitely am not reading as much front list as I normally would.
Yes.
So front list being books that are brand new, that have just come out. I'm definitely just mooching through what I already have. I've read some classics. I'm reading books that I've had for a long time that I just haven't got to. Like, I definitely don't feel as like pressured to keep up with super contemporary publishing.
Yes, I would agree with that. Like, there's things that you're personally interested in, and it's nice to kind of keep up with that. But yeah, I would agree that I feel less kind of like I've kind of dropped out of some kind of race somehow.
Yeah, and it's nice. It's nice to be going at my own pace and reading my own thing.
I do miss, we've discussed this, but we miss the event lifestyle.
I do miss events. I loved every year publishers, only twice a year publishers do showcases where they kind of introduce their debut and their front like titles, authors rather, and then discuss their titles that are coming out over the next 6 months, and there's readings and there's wine and snacks, and you get to like gossip with all the people that you know there, and you do really miss those. I fucking love a good showcase.
Yeah, and without that I kind of feel a bit like I'm not as in tune with what, not only what the kind of hyped books are, but also what the hyped books are that I personally like the sound of. Because obviously, like, I'm not going to like every book that every publisher is pushing as like a lead title. But through those kinds of showcases, I had more of a sense of like, is this my vibe?
Yeah, because I find that there's often more at play than just recognizing a genre that looks good. Or like, you know, I like books by women debut writers in their 20s and 30s is always going to turn my head. Anything that's a bit spooky or witchy is going to turn my head. But it doesn't mean I'm going to read it. There's always other factors that will determine whether or not it's actually going to be a book that's for me.
Yeah, and sometimes something surprises you, and something that you wouldn't have thought was like your thing, you'll be really sold on like an author or a reading or something.
Yeah, definitely. The readings can make such a big difference.
True. So what's the goss in the book world right now?
Well, I feel the biggest thing right now is bookshop.org.
Me too.
Which I have a lot to say about.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you're here, because I feel like it would have taken me a lot longer to figure out the vibe with Bookshop if you were not my bud.
So for those listening, I assume if you're listening to this podcast, you would have already come across bookshop.org online. But in a nutshell, it's a website that was launched last year in the US to great fanfare and success. And it launched here in the UK on Tuesday, the 2nd of November. Monday the 2nd of November. And the idea of it is that it provides a online, like a digital shopfront for indie bookshops. So you can, as an indie bookshop, you can sign up with this website, and then they will fulfill book orders for you. So you don't have to worry about ordering or delivering. You don't have to go into your store to fulfill orders. People can just go to bookshop.org. They pick your bookshop. So for example, Phlox Books is my local store. I could go onto the Phlox page on bookshop.org. I can order my books. Bookshop.org will then place my order with the distributor. The distributor will send me my books, and bookshop.org will give Phlox, my chosen bookshop, 30% of that sale. 50% of that sale goes to the publisher, which is standard, and that's where the author's payment, etc., comes from. And then that remaining 20%, bookshop.org spend on their own their own outgoing. So it's like the cost of keeping the supply chain running, the cost of delivery, etc. Yeah, all of those expenses. So bookshop.org pay individual bookshops more than Hive would do per sale.
Because previously Hive was kind of seen as the ethical alternative to Amazon.
Exactly. And with Hive, I think indies get something like 5% of the sale. So it's a really significant bump in how much profit they get. The other thing with Hive is that I think the cost of, I'm not quite sure how Hive works, but I know that for a lot of indies, fulfilling Hive orders actually ends up costing them money. Yeah. Like Hive is not very popular with indies, but that no one's going to turn their noses up at a sale. So that's the skinny. And obviously on superficially, it sounds really great.
But my, if you dig deeper.
So I started digging because I was really surprised to see people posting affiliate links. And I was like, that's strange. I wonder how that works. So I looked into it. And basically, every single listing for a book will have a link saying, like, earn money by recommending books. So they really want users. They want the consumer to sign up as affiliate. And that's obviously, very simply, that's to help spread word of mouth about this new website's existence. The thing with the affiliate links, if Bethany sets up an affiliate account and she posts her shop front, she creates lists, which is a really great feature and I really like. But obviously, if all the stock's the same, the way that shops can differentiate from one another is that they can tailor their own lists of the kinds of books that they recommend. So say I go on Bethany's affiliate page, she's got a list called Banging Books of 2020. I go on there, I pick Year of the Monkey by Patti Smith, I buy it. Bethany would get 10% of that sale straight into her affiliate account. She can only cash that out when it reaches a certain point. I think it's £20. Happy to be corrected on that, but that's just from memory. But Bethany gets 10%. 10% goes into a pot, which is divided equally between every indie bookshop that's signed up to the website.
And they have this kind of quite cute running total on the homepage, yeah, which shows you how much money has been made for indie bookshops in that pot.
Ah, but is that the pot or is that in total?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's in total.
That's the thing with that figure is that it doesn't make it clear if that's, yeah. I think that's the total. I think that includes sales in which the bookshops have earned 30%.
Yes.
But I might be wrong. Happy to be corrected on that. But anyway, so with an affiliate link, Bethany gets 10%. All indies get 150th of 10%. The 50% goes to the publisher. The remaining 30%, 20% we know bookshop.org spend on their expenses. So then 10% is profit for bookshop.org. So if you have an affiliate link, whilst you are technically supporting indie bookshops, really what you're doing is supporting yourself. You're going to get a bigger share than your local bookshop would. And whilst that's fine, I mean, there's a fucking pandemic. Loads of people have lost their jobs. Booksellers, like people in publishing, authors, so many people in the book world earn fuck all. An affiliate program like this is fucking great. I'm not so sure about positioning it as something that's supporting independent bookshops, though.
Yeah, something that's inherently good for indies, which it kind of isn't always.
Yeah, like I just feel that the maths is not necessarily made as clear as it could be.
Because basically,
when I've talked about this a little bit online, a lot of people have said, oh, really? Wait, I didn't think I made any profit. Or, no, 10% goes to a bookshop of my choice, which none of which is true. If you read the FAQ, it's all there in black and white, but it's literally one of the last questions on a very long FAQ. I have read the whole thing. That is my investigative journalism at work.
This is why I do the pod with you, for your knowledge.
my nosiness.
So, obviously, bookshop.org is good if you buy through an indie on bookshop.org, and otherwise you would have probably ordered from Amazon. That's the thing. It's good.
The dream model is, yeah, if it's removing sales from Amazon to bookshop.org.
But
let's just be really clear about that. The website is nowhere near as functional as Amazon's website, which is unsurprising.
So we've talked about this, but for example, if you look up my name and I've published 3 books that you could search. If you search my name on another bookshop's website, those 3 titles would come up as the first 3 results. Whereas only my most recent book comes up as the first result on bookshop.org, and the others are scattered somewhere through the next kind of six or seven listings, which just is a bit silly because I feel like a search function is one of the easier things to optimize.
Yeah. And like, it's not just you. I've tried it with loads of different books, like with Boy Clarks by Eliza Clark. If you search the title, Eliza's book appears like somewhere like the eighth or ninth listing. If you search the name Eliza Clark, Boy Parts is the first listing. If you search Kirsty Logan, only three of her books appear on the first page. There's just so much other guff that gets in the way.
Yeah.
So I think it's actively designed to be shoppable via these lists. I don't think that they necessarily have put much money into that kind of functionality of just searching and browsing, which if you're trying to take a slice of Amazon's pie, that's what you're competing with.
Which they kind of explicitly are. Like, Amazon gets brought up every time this, you know, in every article about them.
Yeah.
It's always positioned as a rival to Amazon. So, yeah, obviously, if you go onto bookshop.org and buy a book from a shop, not from a person, not from an affiliate, but from an indie shop, that is better than buying off Amazon. But the best thing you can do is still to buy directly from an indie. Like, that hasn't changed.
And that's the thing, is I just feel like I'm not sure who bookshop.org is really aimed at, because people in the book world who follow bookshops on Twitter are all kind of more aware of the bookshop landscape, already know this. We know that the best way, and it's not always necessarily as easy, but
or as cheap,
but you know, the bookshop.org discount's like 40 pence per book discount. It's basically a nominal amount, but we already know the best thing to do is to DM your favorite bookshop and say, hey, could you order these books for me? I'll PayPal you the money. Job's a good one. We know that's the best way to do it. So who are they
aiming for?
Yeah, who is the actual target market? Are they taking sales from Waterstones, Foils, Blackwells? Like, how many people who are shopping with bookshop.org are delighted because now they can finally support their local bookshop in a way that suits them? Versus people who are supporting it because they like the idea in general and feel like it's generally quite a good thing and therefore it's generally a more moral place to shop.
Yeah, I'm just, I think I am struggling a bit with why I would order through bookshop.org. Like, why would I, rather than just going to, you know, DMing Kirkdale Books in Sydenham and saying, can you order this for me?
And I also feel like a lot of people, when I've questioned this, I've had four people so far tell me that with the money they earn through their affiliate link, they're intending to spend with their local indie bookshop directly.
So why not just give that sale to the indie bookshop in the first place?
Or, more to the point, if you're not going to use the service yourself, why are you promoting it?
Yeah.
Why aren't you putting the money back into bookshop.org? And the answer is because they know that it's not as good for bookshops.
Obviously,
it's fine to set up an affiliate link. I'm pro affiliate links.
Me too. I think they're a little bit of money.
Yeah, like, I think they're a really good thing. And as I said, like, there's a fucking pandemic. People need to earn money. Cool. But I think that we need to be a little bit more honest. If you're shopping with an affiliate link, you're supporting the person who has set up the affiliate link first and foremost. And that's fine. But just be aware that that's what you're doing. If you want to support indie bookshops as a kind of amorphous conglomerate thing, which they aren't, that's why we love indies, is because they're all individual. But if you want to support them, then, you know, shopping via an affiliate link is probably the best way to throw less than a penny per shop. I think the last time I did this maths, it works out as like 0.007 pence per 7.99 paperback would go to every indie bookshop, and that number is now going to be lower because more bookshops have signed up.
That's so absurd.
It's just an absurdly small amount, and like, obviously the jury is out. We will see what the I think they cash out every 6 months, the pot gets divided, so let's see how big the pot is. Maybe I'm gonna completely eat my hat, and you'll know if I do because I'll fucking set up an affiliate link. But I can't see myself doing that because I can't see this as being preferable for indie bookshops.
Yeah. I set up an affiliate account before I kind of fully understood what was going on. I was like, oh, cool. Like, I'm an author. Maybe I'll set up an account on this, make a list with my books so that I can link to that if ever someone wants to buy from somewhere that isn't Amazon. But yeah, I think I didn't fully realize that that meant I would get money instead of the indie.
Well, it's as well as, but you can't nominate a specific indie. The best way to do that, if you're an author and you're not worried about earning commission on book sales through your own shop, the best thing you could do is to reach out to your local bookstore and say, hey, are you on bookshop.org? Because they aren't all on there. And say, are you interested in, I'm a local author, here's my books. Would you be interested in hosting a book list for me? I will link to it whenever I'm talking about my books and you can take 30% of the sales. That's the best way as an author to support your local bookshop if you're not interested in earning commission. Also, there's no shame in wanting to earn commission. Like, if you want to set up an affiliate link as an author and fill it with your books and books you recommend, that's chill, do that. But make sure that shoppers know that they're doing that by shopping there, they're supporting you,
you rather
as
than
well.
Indie, but you know, I get it, I know it's as well, but it does kind of feel like instead of.
Yeah, I just don't rate the affiliate program as a way to support indie bookshops.
Yeah.
I've said it. I think that's totally clear.
Well, it's very interesting because, I feel like it's one of those things that the first time you hear about it, you're like, wow, what a great idea. And then the more you find out about it, it's like, this isn't an inherently good thing for indies. If what you want to do is support indie bookshops, nothing has really changed, because if what you were doing before was buying direct from them, you should still buy direct from them.
Yeah. And also, like, obviously, think about where you were shopping previously. I would probably buy most of my physical books from Waterstones, from Daunts, because there was a Daunts near my office that I frequented. Waterstones, Daunts, Foils occasionally, and the indie bookshop on my street. If I ever went to an event at an indie, I would probably buy a book from them, but I think it would be disingenuous for me to pretend that I usually prop up loads of indie bookstores in London. I prop up one indie bookstore in London occasionally. But I'd also question, like, do you want to divert your book buying habits away from your local, or slash, whether even if your local is a part of a bookshop chain like Waterstones or Blackwell's, do you not want to support them?
Yeah.
Like, because they will go.
Yeah.
If we don't continue shopping with the chains, they will also go. And however you may feel about the hierarchy of evil in your mind about capitalism and bookshops, Waterstones has the ability to put stores in places that don't currently otherwise have them. So if you normally would shop in your high street Waterstones, actually maybe the best thing you can do to support the industry is to continue shopping with Waterstones.
So that your maybe high street still has a bookshop.
Yeah, like maybe that's an unsexy thing to say, but at the end of the day, the book buying landscape is completely different than it ever has been in the history of bookshops. Like, the bookshops are closing in the UK, well, they're closing in England this week. They'll be closing from Thursday. So you really have to think about what you want your high street to look like when we come out of the pandemic, when we come out on the other side. What do you still want to be there? I'm not that fussed about supporting a turfy bookshop in a town I've never been to. I'm interested in supporting the bookshops that are run by people who I'm passionate about, who support the publishers that I'm passionate about and the authors that I'm passionate about. Like, I don't think that an independent business is automatically a good thing.
Yeah, just because it's independent. You're so right, my friend.
I'm curious to know how our listeners feel. Please, if you have any corrections about anything that we've said,
or any takes of your own.
Exactly. Very happy to hear. But if you're going to issue a correction, please do your homework and read the FAQ, because there's a lot of information in there that's really good to know.
And Alice is rarely wrong about these things. So
I am wrong all the fucking time. I have to apologize, by the way. I've just realized that normally before recording, Bethany would remind me to remove the various silver bangles on my wrists.
But because we're not in the same place, I can't see them.
She wasn't there to tell me off. And I do have a habit when I'm concentrating, I absentmindedly fiddle with them. So there may have been some little bell-like noises. Think of it as my brain turning over, the cogs whirling as I discuss bookshop.org.
I'm very glad that we have covered this, because I think it's been a real, this is a thing that I think we can have a productive conversation about on this pod, and it might, you know, make a difference to someone who's listening.
And also, like, don't take our word for it. If you care about indie bookshops, follow some on Twitter, see what they're saying. Like, there's a store called Storytellers Inc. Who I really like. I have shopped with them during the pandemic to support them because I think they have a good vibe. But Katie has been talking about, like, very transparently their figures. And obviously for someone like Storytellers Inc., they don't have a functional website. All of her sales come through her work on Twitter, recommending books, supporting authors, retweeting publishers. Like, she's really earning every fucking sale she gets.
Yeah.
So for her, like, the shop front angle is great, and like they had a reasonably good first day of sales. Like I think it was, the figure was something around £37 from 11 sales, which is not to be sniffed at. Yeah. You know, it's good shit. And obviously those are sales that she doesn't have to do anything else. Once the sale is bagged, she doesn't have to place it, she doesn't have to chase it, she doesn't have to pack it and deliver it. Like that's all just money in their pocket. So, you know, like obviously some people are making it work. And so I don't want to be just trashing it for no reason. But I think it's good to ask some questions, keep an open mind. Let's keep an eye on the bookshops that we love, see how much money they actually make. And also let's find out if bookshop.org pay tax in the UK, because it is an American company. So I'm seeing people talking about Amazon as tax dodgers. Let's see if bookshop.org are
also tax dodgers.
Before we start throwing that around.
I feel like we have very comprehensively covered the bookshop.org situation. And with that, we will take our leave.
Yeah, I guess we were talking for quite a long time once we get going.
It takes a lot to stop us.
Well, listen, I am happy as a clam to be back in the driving seat of the good ship, What Page Pod. Do ships have driving seats?
Yeah. Oh, Below Deck is back tonight, speaking of ships and driving seats. So that's something for me to look forward to in my life.
I'm happy for you.
So this has been me, Bethany Rutter, and this has been you,
Alice Slater.
And we'll be back next week, I guess. I wonder what weird stuff's going to happen between now and then.
Please DM us any goss. You can follow the pod at What Page Pod on Instagram and Twitter. You can follow me at Alice MJ Slater on Instagram and Twitter.
And me at Bethany Rutter on Twitter and Bethany_Rutter on Instagram. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.